It's called 2062 for three reasons. I mean, there's a technical reason. I surveyed 300 of my colleagues, other experts in AI, and that's when they expected, on average, that machines, computers, would be as capable as humans. But there was another reason. There's a literary reason, which was that the last book I wrote, I was surprised to discover that the publisher chose the title. So I chose the title this time. I thought, well, they're going to get back to me. They don't like 2062. They're going to say 2061 or 2063. So the good news is I got to keep the title I chose. And the third reason is actually a very personal reason, and only discovered after I finished writing the book and when the book was with the publisher and being printed. I was trying to explain to my daughter, who was 8 at the time, what the book was about. And I said, well, it's sort of the world that you're going to inherit and the choices we need to make to ensure that's a good world. And then I did the maths and I worked out she would be exactly my age in 2062. So it was a bit of a spooky coincidence.
So you're kind of just setting her up for living in your age in the future in a world drastically changed by AI.
It will be drastically changed. I think that's one of the takeaways from the book is that we're going through what's been called the fourth industrial revolution. Computers, digital life is really changing significantly. People make a mistake. They think that the future's actually already fixed, and they ask me, well, what's going to happen, as opposed to what the reality is. The future is the product of the decisions we make today. And whilst technology will change that society gets to change technology. And it's about we making the right decisions now so that it's the sort of world that she would want to be in.
So you're more looking at how culture might influence the AI presence of the future compared to just seeing it as we're going to develop AIs and they're definitely going to emerge as this factor in the future.
It's all about making the right choices about how we let the technology into good parts of our lives and other parts that it won't be so good. And there's nothing, the book is not at all about technology. In fact, I say at the start of the book, the technology by then is going to look like magic. Any sufficiently advanced technology, this is a quote from Arthur C. Clarke, any sufficiently advanced technology will look like magic, and it will be like magic to us. But it will be perhaps some of the most powerful magic that we've ever invented. It's hard to think of an aspect of our lives that it won't be touched in some way, and that we won't have to make choices, just as we made choices in the Industrial Revolution. It's worth remembering we have a good historical precedent here. We went through a similar, very large transformation in the way that we lived. It used to be that all of us were working out in the farms, in the fields, every hour of sunlight we were out there toiling the earth. Now most of us don't do things like that. We live actually much longer lives. Life expectancy here in Australia has almost doubled. And we created lots of new jobs in offices and factories, and we live much better quality lives as a result of the changes we made. But it didn't happen with us just sitting on our hands and letting the owners of the means of production take all the spoils. We did some important changes to our society, important structural changes. We introduced unions and labor laws. We introduced universal education so people are educated for the new jobs. We made some pretty significant changes to the way we ran society to ensure those benefits were spread around, and they were spread around. And I think perhaps we need to reflect on that and think about, well, what changes do we need to make this time to ensure the benefits are shared around? And the problem is we're seeing, at the moment at least, the benefits aren't being shared around. Inequality is increasing drastically in society today. And many people, rightly so, are feeling left behind.
What kind of decisions are currently being made? What kind of trends can you observe about just human nature in general and where we're heading in terms of the potential AI future?
I think where we're heading, if we don't make a few course corrections, isn't going to be a very good one. And actually, many writers, you know, here at Adelaide Writers Week, and many writers have already given us a very clear picture. You know, Orwell, Huxley, many of the dystopian futures we will inherit if we do nothing, if we allow the technology to invade our privacy, if we allow our political discourse to be further fractured, if we allow inequality to widen the divisions within our society. There are many worrying trends. And the book really is just picking up those trends and saying, well, if we extrapolate from where we are today, there are some potentially quite bad futures waiting us. Equally, there are some very good futures waiting us, that the robots could take the sweat. They could do the dirty, the dull, the difficult and the dangerous. We could sit back and enjoy the finer things in life. It's all about making the right choices as how the technology is used to lift the quality of everyone's life.
I want to start with the controversies behind this kind of thing first, because there are people feeling that they're losing their agency, that job security is at risk. You've got people potentially losing their jobs and just being replaced by AI that, as you said, just leads to more wealth inequality. The rich get richer because they control the tech. They control their AIs. They can choose anything that they really want to happen because they have this this propriety sort of entitlement. How can that sort of be influenced to sort of make a more egalitarian society?
You know, it's a very valid concern that people have about the loss of agency, about how many people might be unemployed or unemployable, how the robots may take many of the jobs. We really do have to worry about these things. I don't think it's going to be as bad as some of the forecasts have made, some of the very dire predictions. You know, half of all jobs are going to be automated. It's actually going to be much harder to automate many jobs than the economists have predicted. Take my word from it as a technologist. But it will be very disruptive. And many jobs will be lost. If you're a taxi driver or a truck driver in 10 or 20 years' time, I very much doubt we will be paying almost anyone to drive a taxi or a truck, because it's going to be far cheaper and far safer to get a robot to do that. And so for most of us, that's going to be good news, but not if you earn your living by driving. So you have to ask yourself, if you're one of those people, well, what other skills have I got? Because driving isn't a skill that we're going to be paying many people for much longer. And there will be plenty of new jobs created. Many of these studies ignore the fact that the history of technology has been one in which many more jobs have been created than have ever been destroyed. If we look at the last industrial revolution, the last 100 years, employment is at historical low levels, at 4 or 5% in most countries. Populations are at historical high levels. So we've created lots of new jobs. Despite the automation of much of the work that went on in farms and in factories, we've created lots of new jobs in offices and doing things with new technologies that didn't even exist 20 years ago. I mean, no one was a social media promoter 20 years ago because we didn't have social media. No one was a smartphone app developer 20 years ago because we didn't have smartphones. So there'll be lots of new jobs created. We don't know ultimately what the balance is, whether more jobs get created than destroyed. And no one has any idea what the balance is. And there's no reason, just because in the past more jobs were created than destroyed, that is necessarily the so. So we have to entertain that idea that maybe more jobs will be destroyed. But one thing we are absolutely certain about is that the new jobs will require different skills. They will use the new technologies, for example, than the old jobs. And so we really have to think carefully through, how do we support people through these transitions? People need to, you know, keep re-educating themselves. Education is going to be a lifelong thing. But how do our institutions, how do our companies support us, how does our government support us, provide the sticks and carrots so that we can continue to reskill ourselves through whatever transitions happen? And people say now, you know, young people today can expect to have a dozen different careers during the course of their lifetime. It's not one job that you do for life. So how do we support people through those changes so that they can live the sorts of lives and they can, you know, have families and feel safe and secure and enjoy the things that, you know, our grandparents all enjoyed?
Not only do we have this economic outlook that we're looking at, but we're also looking at the more political side of things. We had the 2016 election that supposedly had a lot of meddling due to these new technologies, and AI can potentially influence future elections if they are savvy enough, if there's been enough work put behind them. But it also has unique opportunities also to enhance specific political institutions, being able to average your citizen and turn it into an AI as a representative of a district, for instance. What can you see in the future in terms of the good and the bad, in terms of the political sphere and how that is going to change?
Again, you're right. There's good futures and bad futures, and you know, hopefully we'll get more of the good than the bad. We saw the good with the Arab Spring. We saw how social media, Twitter and Facebook were used to mobilize support and give those people back their democratic voice. But equally, we've seen with the Trump election and with the Brexit vote, we've seen how people's voices, people's votes can be potentially manipulated, and we may end up with the wrong people being elected. This is something we need to be really concerned with. We have to wake up to the potential destructive effects. You know, I call them weapons of mass persuasion. And we don't want, at the end of the day, the people with the best algorithms and the most data to win elections. We have very strict rules, for example, about how much money you can use in elections. We don't want the richest people to win. We want the people with the best ideas, the most democratic support. And I start to think maybe we need to have similar strong rules about how much you can use social media. Because we don't want the people who are most effective at using social media to win. We want the people who have the best ideas and the most democratic support for those ideas. So maybe we should, you know, severely limit how much you can use social media. As an example, I think I suggest in the book, maybe you should not be able to narrow cast political adverts. Maybe you should have to broadcast adverts. If you've got a message to say, you should have to say it to everyone, not to divide and cut up your electorate and sell some of them perhaps untruths that no one else will ever see. So maybe we need to think very carefully about how this tool can be used so that it improves the quality of our political debate and doesn't actually hurt the political debate as it seems to be at the moment.
There's also concerns in regards to environment and how the increased computing power will depend upon a lot of electricity, and this might contribute to climate change or just bogging down just the costs associated. How can AI work with that and maybe even avert it?
You're right, we need to be concerned. About 5% of the world's energy is being used by compute servers, and it's only set to increase. And then there are problems like blockchain, which is using more than a couple of percent of the world's energy for doing absolutely useless stuff. So we should be very concerned about how we do that. Of course, increasingly, technology companies are focused on actually doing more with less. Intel, for example, they're not trying to double the transistor count on their chips anymore. They're trying to improve the power consumption of their chips. That will mean that we can do more on our mobile devices. So we do have to worry about these things. And increasingly, AI is not only part of the problem, but part of the solution, that actually we can better use the world's resources, use the world in a more sustainable way if we make better decisions, we get the machines to make better decisions. I've been working with some very large multinational companies looking at optimizing their supply chain, and we've been able to save their transport costs by 10%. That's a big saving, big improvement to their bottom line, but it's also 10% less CO2. The trucks drive 10% less distance to visit the same places because they go around more intelligently. And that's a big reduction in the carbon footprint of that business. And you know, it's the same that we need to do in all businesses.
One of the big problems with getting people on board with AI is trust. There's a lot of negative media depictions of how AI might form thanks to just this narrative structure of needing conflict. How does trust matter in trying to get people involved in AI? And how can it really gel with just humans in general if AI is maybe taking away from the human sense of meaning?
Trust is really important, and trust is something that, in fact, the tech industry is starting to lose, and there's been starting to be a bit of a tech lash there. It is something that we really have to work on. I think in some places, you know, things like the surveillance economy that companies like Facebook, it's hard to reconcile that with actually having any trust at all. And I do wonder how long those businesses can continue in that particular type of economic model. There's a lot of misconceptions about AI. I do wonder whether we should, perhaps the best thing we should do is actually employ some scriptwriters in Hollywood to actually write some more plausible narratives, because a lot of what Hollywood would tell you about, you know, Terminator-like scenarios are so far in the future, are such a distant worry. There's much more pressing problems that we need to, much more mundane things that we need to worry about. So maybe we should get people focused on gaining their trust. And we need, ultimately, though, more regulation. We've allowed the tech industry a completely free hand. And that's brought a lot of interesting, useful disruption in our lives. It's hard to imagine what the world would be like without the internet, how we would run government or businesses or our lives, our social lives, without the internet. It really has been a great benefit. But equally, there's been a few downsides. And we're discovering maybe, like, you know, any activity, it needs to have walls within which to work. And we have been giving the social media companies in particular too much freedom to act. And so we will need to regulate more. And we're starting to see that. We're starting to see that, for example, especially in places like Europe, the General Data Protection Regulation, the GDPR Act, that has given you privacy, that even on Australia, you've been clicking on those waivers, those releases on websites for the last couple of months. Because of the regulation that Europe brought in to try and give you better data privacy, better data rights. And that's only the beginning of the conversation and the change, the regulation that we need to make sure that the technology is used to improve the quality of our lives and isn't used to surveil us all the time and to turn us into a very Orwellian state that it could be. And actually, sadly, we are seeing in places like China already.
What do you reckon is the best sort of portrayal of AI in popular culture?
Ah, well, if we're thinking of movies, it's hard to think of a good movie, and most of them have very dystopian ends to them. The one that I do really like, and many of my colleagues like as well, is the movie Her, which is very much about the relationship we're going to have with machines. It's about how AI isn't going to be the operating system of the future. Increasingly, we've got smartphones, smart speakers, all the devices in our lives, the front door, the light bulbs, they're all going to be connected to the internet. And most of these things don't have screens or keyboards. The only interface, the only way of communicating with these devices is if we speak to them and they speak to us. And so increasingly, you're going to have this conversation. It's going to follow you around. You're going to be talking to this thing, asking, you know, who won the footy last night? And something in the room, it might be the light bulb, it might be the front door, will answer and it will recognize who you are biometrically, will know which team you support, and will go and look up the good or bad news. So we're going to have this very interesting conversation. It will follow us around from room to office to car, back to home. There will be a lifelong conversation, and these machines will get to know us better than our spouses. And it will be, you know, some people will, I suspect, become quite attached, as in the movie, Her, with these devices. And so it's going to be a very interesting relationship, a very interesting future that we have as interactions we have with these machines. And it will be ultimately that we will be having these conversations that follow us around.
Do you have any closing remarks?
It's all about making the right choices, about realizing the future's yet to be decided. And it's about a conversation that the whole of society should be having. That's why I've written the book, is to encourage people to think about these issues, because it's not for technologists to decide what sort of society it should be, how the nature of work should change, how the nature of privacy should be changed. This is a questions for the whole of society, for everyone, all your listeners, to decide, to lobby your politicians, to go out and campaign for, to see that, you know, we wake up in a world in which our grandchildren have better quality lives than we do.